Hey there, ever thought about what makes your heart beat a little faster?
Oh, you mean like when you discover a new track that just speaks to you?
Yeah, or finding a movie that you can't stop thinking about?
Well, get ready to feel that excitement all over again because Amazon Prime is here to take your entertainment and shopping experience to the next level.
Absolutely. Prime isn't just about getting your packages quicker. It's about diving into a world of endless possibilities. From the latest releases to exclusive content you won't find anywhere else.
And don't even get me started on the music. Prime offers concert specials that will transport you right to the front room. It's like being at the hottest gigs without leaving your living room.
I use Prime to tap in with some of my favorite artists' live shows from any and every genre of music.
Trust me, Prime is a game changer. It's like having a personalized superstore and entertainment hub right at your fingertips.
So why wait? Head over to Amazon.com/Prime and start experiencing entertainment like never before.
This is the OAccess Jamaica podcast, Reasonings with Odessa, episode 9.
Now special dedication to all dogs of dogs, dedicated to all top dogs, Liberty Crew. Man called Tony Kennedy, man called Robert, and while the fights are riding through. Curfew! Sometimes I'm back, some of them are rally back. We are road wild, and we don't take back the chat. Sometimes I'm back, some of them are rally back. But we are road wild, and we don't take back the chat. The full of big chat and can't defend that. If a jailhouse you come from, we're sending you go back. The full of big chat and can't defend that. If a Bellevue you come from, we're sending you go back.
Hey, 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 what's up, everybody? Sound the big ting. Odessa is back with another Reasonings. This is episode 9, by the way. And yes, I am just, you know, keeping this thing going and flowing. All right, so Kanye West was here on the island. He flew in and he flew out. He did a really cool show at Emancipation Park. There was a lot of uproar. A lot of people were arguing with me on Facebook about Kanye. And you know, I don't really care about his Trump politics. I'm just a fan of Kanye West, the musician, the musical genius that he is. There was two arguments. One that the government chose to have Kanye West here on the weekend celebration of our beloved Peter Tosh. And some people were like questioning if it's affecting the celebrations of Peter Tosh. Like, many of these people don't even celebrate Peter Tosh's, you know, year or anything to do with our dear brother, you know? So I don't even understand what the uproar was. There was an amazing event that took place for Peter, celebrating his Jubilee year the next day. So what was the uproar about? Oh, merchandise. Kanye West came down, he had merch with the Jamaican code. Is it what we call it? The code of arms on the t-shirt with a map of Jamaica behind and some other jazz. But, you know, there was a big of an uproar. I think it slipped the Ministry of Culture and, you know, Auntie Babsy, as I affectionately call her, the Minister of Culture and also Gender, told them that they need to take that off of the site. It was taken down and everybody's moved on. So why are people still arguing about it? You know, mostly it was the people on Facebook that were arguing about it. Those that listen to my podcast and those that are on Facebook, you know who you are. Anyway, Jesus is King, the album by Kanye West, is out right now. And I listened to it. I like it up to track 8. And that's it. Bob's your uncle. All right. So we're going to be moving on because I have an amazing guest. This man doesn't really give interviews. This man don't really talk to people that much. This man just makes music. And we're moving on from Kanye West, one musical genius, to another musical genius. I was very honored to sit down and talk to the one and only Salaam Remy, producer extraordinaire. He's just amazing. He's a Caribbean man. And yeah, let's just get into this. Reasonings with Odessa with Salaam Remy. We good. All right, so Reasonings with Odessa. I can't believe I'm sitting in front of my homeboy, who's hands down one of our musical geniuses of this generation. Run the nation with Version. Thanks for taking the time out, Salaam, to come and link with me, man. I'm very happy.
That's cool. You make big man blush, so I'm just going to grin.
Oh, gosh, man. Oh, gosh, man. Let me talk in my Bajan accent, man. Oh, gosh.
The Wackburn Bills.
Yes, we have to keep up the Caribbean thing. So I'm going to kick it off because a lot of people don't know. I don't even know. How many instruments do you play?
I played basic rhythm section. I played drums since a baby. I played bass pretty much. Bass, drums, guitar, keys for the most part, and then fiddle around with other stuff, percussions and things, of course. But that's, you know, 4 or 5, I guess, is the main thing.
And that's a lot. That's
I'm starting to play a little horns, but I'm toying with it. But you know, that's the next frontier.
So who you was taught by Icons? Who taught you to play the drums? Like you started at 3, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, actually, you know, the thing is, I was born as my father. Is a musician, and his brothers were all musicians. And then my mother and her sisters all sang, and her brothers were musicians.
Damn.
So where I actually came from was my dad was in a band with my uncle, my mother's brother.
What's the name of the band?
I think at one point they were calling it Stone Free. So that was pre-conception of me. And then that's where I come from, you know, basically musical side of both sides of the family. And then by the time I was young, you know, I was playing the trap drum set, as they referred to it at that time, you know, not hand drums, but trap drums, and being able to play a basic, you know, disco beat. And on my 3rd birthday, my dad took me to the music store, and Elvin Jones saw me kind of playing with some drums and basically put together a drum kit for me.
Wow.
So that was the start of my having a real drum kit, you know. That was pretty much kind of like what Questlove kits are now, where they're made small enough for a kid. He put together a floor tom and stuff and made a kit for me that I had.
That's what he did for Sean Paul's son. He sent him a little mini little kit.
Drum kit, right. Yeah. You know, and I actually use those Questlove kits on records, Bill Questlove. But, you know, it reminds me of when I was a kid and I had those that little tone to it.
When did you get your first, like, keyboard? I was reading something about you carrying a keyboard to school.
I got that in 7th grade, so that would have been, I was 11, 1983. I had a keyboard that I was able to not only play on it, but I was able to program the drums in it. So I basically had a keyboard where, you know, it was still Casio sound.
Yeah.
It was a little Yamaha keyboard that my dad and my uncle bought from Japan. But actually in the keyboard, I could program, you know, whatever I thought was the hip-hop beat and then change the key and do all that, you know, slang-tang type stuff pretty much. But I could program it and do stuff with it. So I've pretty much been programming since I was 11.
Wow. And yeah. What was your first track that you actually made? Like, when did you make your first, like, your first beat?
I was making, because see, the fact was I could play drums. So I actually was making beats as soon as I had a drum machine, which would have been probably 85, I got a Roland 707, and I was able to kind of program whatever it was. But I understood it from messing with the little Yamaha keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, I had records. I had things I'd done. But the first thing that came out that I worked on was the record that my dad was working on with Curtis Blow.
How did that happen?
On the Kingdom Blow album. So that ended up becoming my first production, technically, and my first writer's credit, signed up to ASCAP, and kind of had that stuff going.
At what age was that? Like,
I was 14.
Damn.
So that was that part of it. But then I was making better records, in my opinion, as demos with me and my friends. And then by 89, when I got out of high school, I was like full-fledged in it. But prior to that, I just kept learning. You know, it was a thing where I wanted to learn and figure stuff out. So I put the time in, you know, and I really was making sure I had more than 10,000 hours of each different aspect of it.
So music is like, you eat, breathe, shit, 24 hours, music?
No, I wouldn't say even 24 hours. It's the fact that it's a language that I'm versed in. You know, there's some people that speak the unspoken language of music, and I just think I was blessed to have it in my bloodstream to where I could hear something and feel it,
mm-hmm,
when I don't even know what it was, and then just taking the time to know how to recognize it and execute it. So it's just a whole other flow.
We're going to go into your father, your legendary father, Van Gibbs. Like, for those that don't know anything of Van Gibbs, can you tell us who this man is? I know who Van Gibbs is.
You know, so it always looks different from me. Dad.
Well, it's the same situation with me.
Understood. So it's a dad thing. But basically, my dad was a Trinidad. He was born in Trinidad. His father was from Barbados, born to a Trinidadian mother. And he grew up there. When he turned 18, he went to America. When he went to America, he was in bands and stuff all through the 70s. Ended up playing like on disco records and different things. And then he turned to going to more into the music business. So he worked on Jazz Mobile, worked on disco records, kind of different things. But then he got, you know, bad deals. So then he actually went to intern at Arista Records as a big man. Then he became a promotion person who, you know, then built up, was a Northeast Regional, you know, worked with Frankie Crocker. And whatever it was, he kind of excelled at it and was a people person, but as well as a creative. Then he went on to, you know, manage many people and pretty much do all the label stuff. But in that journey, you know, he's the first person to take Dougie Fresh in the studio. Dougie mm-hmm. Fresh's first song was an 82, a song called Pass the Dutchie. That was a cover of
Musical Use
Pass. Well, no, actually,
hey there, ever thought about what makes your heart beat a little faster?
Oh, you mean like when you discover a new track that just speaks to you?
Yeah, or finding a movie that you can't stop thinking about?
Well, get ready to feel that excitement all over again because Amazon Prime is here to take your entertainment and shopping experience to the next level.
Absolutely. Prime isn't just about getting your packages quicker. It's about diving into a world of endless possibilities, from the latest releases to exclusive content you won't find anywhere else.
And don't even get me started on the music. Prime offers concert specials that will transport you right to the front room. It's like being at the hottest gigs without leaving your living room.
I use Prime to tap in with some of my favorite artists' live shows from any and every genre of music.
Trust me, Prime is a game changer. It's like having a personalized superstore and entertainment hub right at your fingertips.
So why wait? Head over to Amazon.com/Prime and start experiencing entertainment like never before.
The version was called Pass the Buddha, which is the slang for weed at that time, which was a cover of Pass the Dutchie, which of course was still Cutchy Rhythm.
Yeah.
And then he had Sly and Robbie, who he was helping out. You know, he was helping out Gwen Guthrie and different people in the early 80s. And Sly and Robbie actually came in and cut the rhythm track. And then Dougie Fresh went to the studio and rapped on it. And that was pretty much probably one of the first reggae and hip-hop raw fusions that came together.
Yeah.
Where you really had the Jamaican musicians and then a kid from Harlem that didn't know nothing about it rapping over it, trying to cover a song. But it happened. Of course, hip-hop comes from reggae
exactly.
and dancehall, but that was like one of the first.
I want to cut you and just say, like, finish this. Hip-hop is, and what was the first hip-hop track that you actually heard that was just poignant in your life, that's just life-changing? Hip-hop is, finish that.
So hip-hop for records, I would say, is Rapper's Delight. That became the record that everybody knew, hip-hop, the hip, the hop, the hip-hop. That was where it was. You know, at the time Rapper's Delight came out, I was 7 years old. So what was happening in the Bronx and what was happening before that, I heard remnants of it. I saw it at block parties. I heard music coming. But that was the first time I heard a song, and it came back the exact same way. I didn't have a popular rap tape for my generation prior to that record coming out. So for me, Rapper's Delight is the start.
And that was mine too. That exactly was mine. And growing up in the UK, hearing that, it was just, it did. It just changed. It just changed my life. And it was just like, this is, even though I grew up reggae background, who my father is and stuff, I'm very much a hip hop head. I'm very much a hip hop girl. So yeah. All right. So how did you come to meet Funkmaster Flex?
So, in my dad's travels and workings and buildings, he started managing Chuck Chillout. He was doing promotion and doing different things. And Chuck was on, you know, one of the radio pioneers for hip-hop on the radio. Red Alert and Chuck Chillout were on Kiss FM in New York. And Flex was actually one of Chuck's, you know, drivers, pretty much. Like, he would drive Chuck around. Where I need to go over here? I'm going downtown. Flex is, you know, one of the DJ. And he was DJing in a group that Chuck was managing at the time. Some of Chuck's neighbors, Deuces Wild was the name of the group, and Flex was their DJ. So from the time that I had moved in with my dad, I got out of high school, moved to my dad in 1989, Flex was always running around with Chuck. So to the point where sometimes Chuck was being irresponsible with his time and his life. And then he wouldn't show up to stuff. So then it would just be me or Flex kind of taking Chuck's energy. Chuck could have been in the studio more, which he had an album that was on my dad's label with Cool Chip. Mm-hmm. And then he could have been at the radio more. So Flex and I pretty much were built off of Chuck's foundation. Uh-huh. But we just kept our consistency and our hunger there.
What is it about Funkmaster Flex that, what did he mentor you? How did he mentor you? How did he shape you to, what did he teach you about, like?
I can't even say that Flex really mentored me. I think it was more that we came up together. Mm. So while he was, it's almost like a selector and then having, you know, the person at the sound and knowing what's what, I would be the one that wrote down the records that we were at the radio station.
Yeah.
So I would write down the records and give it to him. We were using my turntables. He would be doing stuff. But then when it was time for him to go into clubs and he was getting hired by Puffy and different people to do stuff, or when he finally got to Hot 97, I was the person that knew how his radio show should run. So I knew how to produce the radio show. Or I knew what should happen. I'd be standing with him in the booth at a club, and I'm like, yo, Leaders of New School walked in. No, Buster just walked in. Play Leaders of New School. I would be watching the crowd and knowing what he needed to do. And by knowing better what the DJ needed to do, then I was able to produce records better. So basically the same thing that happens, and what I'm excited about even in, you know, when Jamaican music was that you had a dance on Friday or Saturday and a song would play. And when a song played, people responded to it. They liked it. They liked the music, whatever it was. And then the next week, the dance is coming again. So all during that week, you're like, nah, we got to get this better. You know what? This guy was over here. You know what? We did good. But now it's almost like being the trainer in the corner. So I would be the person that would be at the radio station with Flex or in the clubs during my early part of my career. But also, I knew how to go home and make the records that would work for the club.
Yeah.
Not that my friend was going to play it. Mm-hmm. No, that I knew what he needed to now kill next week.
So everything, if you listen to every track that Salaam Remy has produced, from Nas to Fugees to even Amy Winehouse, there's always an underbed of reggae underneath it. Why is that so special for you to do?
I think that what happens is, you know, growing up in New York, Jamaican culture is kind of part of New York culture. You know, when I went to the store, and I was mentioning the other day, I was talking to a veteran artist, and I was like, yeah, I used to go to J&M Records in Brooklyn. And then J&M Records, I could walk in, and I could see a Sugar Hill record, but I also could see a Yellow Man record. And I wanted both, you know what I'm saying? I wanted the Yellow Man songs at the same time while I wanted the Sugar Hill records or whatever the current, you know, the Enjoy labels. I started to recognize the 12-inch just look of the sleeves from a rap record, and I could see it from a distance, so I wanted both of them. So for me, you know, always having a tenth of something, you know, Shinehead, what Shinehead meant for what hip-hop radio felt like, but then what he was doing on the dance hall, you know, toasting Tim and singing, Shinehead is New York to me.
Yeah, he is.
He's a lot of other stuff, but he's definitely New York. And the Rough and Rugged album means so much across the board to me that that's part of where it goes. So I feel like the hint of reggae culture in all my music is there. And then also as I began, you know, producing reggae artists, it's like it's just foundation. Number one, the rhythm should be boom. It should be something that's in there, captures an emotion. Number two, what's this conversation? From the intro or the first few lines of a song, you got to tune me in or I'm tuned out. And then the third part is make sure that that mix is sonically kicking. You know,
I always say, make sure the bass line is heavy like my bottom.
There you go. Balance out your life. You don't want to get dizzy.
Yeah, exactly.
So then you go and you get both sides of it and you say, cool, as long as you have all those things. And that's the basis of all music to me at this point, doing is good. But, you know, I was able to find that balance through reggae because that's what I was working on.
Favorite, like, all right, everyone says that Spraga is your favorite dancehall artist. Is that true?
That's odd for me to say. So Spraga is definitely one of my best friends, period. I would say he's my favorite dancehall artist. I don't know if I would say that.
Because everybody I talk to, like, I know Spraga Salaam's favorite. I'm like, I don't know.
I mean, people can't figure out my favorite rapper. And then people get that wrong all the time. Like,
who is your favorite rapper?
There you go. So people would assume it'd be Nas or something. Like, yeah. I'm looking up. Slick Rick's my favorite rapper.
Oh, and this, you know, again, Slick brings a little bit of the hip-hop and the Jamaican vibe together. You know, he grew up around the corner from my dad. Literally up the road on Lady Musgrave Road. So big up, Slick Rick.
There we go. So with Slick Rick, I feel the energy of what is there. Who's my favorite DJ? I have to say Supercat.
Why is that? What is it that you love about Cat?
I don't know, just the way, I mean, because of course Cat hasn't put out as much music as, say, a Spry Guy is still making number one albums right now, Big Up Chilligan.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, you know, those songs and what they meant and how they hit me, Boops, Enough Mine Are Dead, you know, I told Cat recently, Enough Mine Are Dead is probably my song. He's like, well, you work on Get a Red Hot. I was like, I worked on Get a Red Hot, but Enough Mine Are Dead is my tune. Like, yeah, that's how I feel about it. And I just feel like, you know, Cat and Slick Rick got something in common. I don't know what. Okay, cool. Well, everybody else, Nas and Spragga, got something in common. Yeah. They're both my boys. Those are my contemporaries. But there's something before me that inspired me to really go,
I think because you, I don't know, with you and Spragga are very kind of got an aloofness about you. When I met Spragga, people were like, Spragga don't talk to people. So why is he talking to you? I'm like, I don't know. When you're a man that don't, you're not a man of many words with everybody.
We talk a lot. It's just that we ain't talking in front of everybody and we ain't trying to be the loudest person in the room.
Right.
Spragg will be really quiet till he gets on stage. But in general, he talk to people when he's ready.
That's what I'm saying.
But
like,
he don't talk to everybody.
But he don't talk to everybody.
Nah. We stand back. But honestly, Nas don't talk to a lot of people. But if you catch Nas by himself, he gonna have a real conversation with you.
Yeah.
And then he'll dip off. You know, there's still a mystique, I guess.
Yeah.
In certain ways, but it's not because we're trying to be mysterious.
It's like Dave Kelly with his aloofness as well, and Dave can talk a lot, but
exactly.
He's just...
The last time Dave came by my yard, I thought he was going to stay for half an hour. He stayed for like 3-4 hours. He gifted me some beautiful koi fish. Thank you,
oh,
Dave.
Oh,
and the Kelly family for gifting me with their pets, and I've been, you know, working on those things. But at the end of the day, yeah, if you have something good to talk about, then you talk. And if there's nothing good to talk about, I decide what conversations I want to have.
Yeah.
And you can ask me whatever you want
to
ask me.
Because he told me that. You said to me, you're in debate. You used to do debate club.
I mean.
Like.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Oh,
no, but I was in high school. I was in debate. I was on the debate team, and I was on the mock trial team. Not because I wanted to, just because I was able to.
What was it about debate that you like?
I don't like to debate. I don't like to argue. But I know how to drop a one-liner that will make you leave me alone.
It's just like a sound man.
That's it. I mean, ultimately, even if you're writing songs, there's a long, 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 long set of lyrics and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But then what are you going to say right now that gets to the point? What's the title that wins?
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
It's going to just tap that emotion.
Yeah. And it's like, well, that's really, you talk for half an hour. Okay, cool. But what you really said was this. Ah, that's what I meant to say. Done. So that's, you know, if you have a long story, that's cool. But if the headline's not right, I'm not reading the story.
True. Or you can have clickbait headlines.
Yeah, not clickbait, because we're not bait for anybody.
No, be it, no one. Uh-uh. All right, so Amy Winehouse, a lot of people, like the newbies that know you, like, oh, he produced for Amy Winehouse. What was it like? What was Amy like? I asked you this question before, but now we're doing the podcast. What was it like? What was it about Amy that you really loved? That you really loved about her?
Just as a person, Amy was jokes all the time. Like, you couldn't sit around her for 20 minutes and she didn't say something ridiculous that's going to have you crying. All the time, she could sit there and look at the situation and, you know, she had a great memory. You know, she got along with us, you know, I'm a Virgo rising Taurus, but we got along on some earth signs to sit back and watch, decide who we want to talk to. But Amy had jokes, and if you listen to her songs, really, you know, what locked us in the first sessions were that I let her say what she want to say. And she'd be like, I can cuss? I'm like, yep. I can say whatever it was. And so then now she'd be challenging me. I'm like, so what you going to say next? What you going to say next? What you going to say next? And she would take it to the next level every time and make it better. And that's where we won. We won by her being able to say how she felt without filtering it.
Which is really what music should be, as far as I'm concerned.
Should be, with a great melody and some positive wordplay. You know what I'm saying? And she's a great writer. So her writing and her singing was there. But as a person, it's jokes. Like, she called me on Skype in the middle of the night when everybody fell asleep, security, everybody fell asleep. And she's like, oh, you're still up. It's 5 a.m., but it's only been midnight for you. Hello. Yeah, so what happened was today, and then I literally be like, okay, cool. You know, I'd be working sometimes, and she's just, my phone, my computer start ringing. I'm like, oh.
Do you have do you have any unreleased music for Amy?
Nah, not really. Nah. I mean, whatever happened when she passed away in 2011, I tried to put together anything that was almost in that shape to put out for the Lioness LP, because I wanted to leave her passing and everything in 2011 and then being a fresh bass in 2012. That was my goal. So there's no real songs like that. You know, there's maybe other versions of things that came out, but they came out in the versions that they were intended to. But nah, it's not anything like that.
Okay,
well,
so
not for me.
Listeners, how I knew Salaam when I first heard of Salaam Remy was through my cousin Sipo, who used to manage Aini Kamozi, the great Aini Kamozi.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, what was it like working with Aini as an artist, and how did you come about producing the Hot Stepper, the big Hot Stepper track?
So it was a kind of a connection to a connection to a connection. Basically, there was a manager named David Sonnenberg.
Okay, that was my dad's ex-manager.
There you go. So there was a manager named David Sonnenberg in New York, and he had this group called Natural Selection. Natural Selection was one black guy, one white guy. They were renting our studio at one point in New York, because my dad always kept a studio. And I was, at the time, living in an apartment above the studio, living in, like, pretty much an apartment above the studio. So he hears me making beats, and he's like, dag, those are the type of beats we need. We need real hip-hop. And they were really a pop group. So then he's like, hey, would you mind meeting my manager? So I'm like, all right, cool. And they had a hit at the time. So I went up to David's office on Riverside Drive in the city. And when I get there, he's like, hey, so this is a scenario. And then he tells me about the group, and he plays me a song. And I was 18, but I was like, you know what? I don't need to take your money. Keep your money. The song doesn't need a remix. It's already good as it is. Thanks a lot and goodbye. And he was so impressed that I turned down his money, number one, and just told him the record doesn't need that. It's a pop record. Let it be. Thanks for meeting you. And, you know, was ready to walk out the door. That when Sipo brought Aini Kamozi to him, the first person he could think of that might be able to do some work with Aini Kamozi was myself. So then he came back around, and we struck a deal to create some demos. Hot Stepper, the Fattest Burrell version, was already a hit, and things were going on. But now he found himself in New York, and they were working on different things. So then Aini would be around, you know, pretty much chilling in the projects or somewhere on the low. But he was watching all the rappers, you know, Dos FX, Cypress Hill, everything that was going on. And this would have been 91, 92. More like 91 into 92. So he would be looking at Day One Effects by Dos FX, Cypress Hill's Hole in Your Head, and na 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 na. So that's where na 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 na. So directly the na 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 na. How Can I Just Kill a Man? All that stuff. That is directly where he took the na 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 na. Everything. I'm the Lyrical Gangster. All the, you know, I Know What Bo Don't Know is a Dos FX, could have been line, but it wasn't. It was Aini's version of doing that. And we put together a track that initially had a very hip-hop feeling when it was there. And it was cool. We had that, and we had three or four other songs that we were shopping. Atlantic came with a deal, but it wasn't enough money for Aini to be able to move to New York, and it was just a low budget, so sorry, Craig, we didn't do that. And then eventually Aini had moved back to Jamaica, and things had kind of looked like they went away. But meanwhile, I was doing a lot of work for Columbia Records and working on Shaba and Patra, remixing Supercat, working with Maxine Stone, a bunch of things. And what ended up happening was they had an album compilation called Stir It Up. So I said, hey, maybe the song could go and Stir It Up. Maxine was like, wow, okay, I'll try that. And then I brought David back in, and David got a deal for Whirl a Girl.
Right.
David style. And then I'm like, hey, what about the Aini record? So they put it on the compilation. And it wasn't really going anywhere yet. And then I remixed it and put Heartbeat underneath it. And at that time, Hot 97 is just starting up. And Flex and Angie Martinez are there. And after one of the radio shows, like on a Friday night, I played them my 4-track version from my house. I'm like, what you think about this? And he's like, I like that. So I went back home. I ended up sampling Heartbeat. Backstory in Heartbeat real quick. My dad produced a lot of records. He produced or arranged an EP, an LP for a woman named Tana Gardner who made Heartbeat called Work That Body. If you look at the records, it says arranged by Van Gibbs.
Right.
There was one leftover track that wasn't used on the album. That my dad pretty much made off of It's a Shame. While we were away in summer of 79, he was hanging out with the royal family of Monaco and with my dad's extravagant trips and working, you know, playing with, I think, artist Vivian Reed or something there. We were away. We come back. They put out a record. It was the track that my dad had already created that was left over.
Oh, wow.
So when it was time for Here Comes the Hot Stepper to now become the hit that it was, the biggest selling record on Heartbeat as a sample, the deal was different because I didn't realize it to that depth, but my dad had created that and it gotten not credited properly and didn't get his credit for it. And it was cool as an 80s hit, but the 90s hit really made, and I was actually able to go back to something that my dad did and flip it. So Here Comes the Hot Stepper comes out, and he's like, oh, so this tune is going on? And cool, but after a while, he's like, yo, there's something about this that seems like it's going to be
big.
You know, he's like, at first I thought it was just an 80s hand clapping tune. Oh, you put that underneath it, okay, cool. But it really took up, and Angie Martinez mentioned it to the program director. It was on Hot 97. My dad being a promotion person, he got on the box in Houston. We ended up on a bunch of radio stations. And to this day, it's one of those songs that just
you know, blew up. It just took over.
Took over. The Smurfs doing it in Swedish, the Wyoming, every country, everywhere else. But, you know, once again, it was a fresh energy. It wasn't, it was the first pop number one record on the Billboard that had one of those 80s loops prior to Puff having hits like that and everyone else. And we were ahead of the curve because of the blend of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a great time.
It was just like no one would expect a roots reggae artist like Aini Kamoze to be on a number one pop record like that. It was
not at that time. And then for me, it was also, I was in the clubs with Flex, and then also at that time with Bobby Condors. So we would have sets, and the set was the reggae that was coming out of Jamaica was very strong at that time in the early 90s. So we had a strong reggae set. Then we had a strong classic set, which would be Heartbeat, Kenny Burke Riding to the Top, Gap Band Outstanding. Those records would still play. And then we had hip-hop that was going on at that time. So for my first...
Hey everyone, it's Jalen here from the Black Wealth Renaissance podcast. If you're a fan of business podcasts, then be sure to check out and subscribe to the Black Wealth Renaissance podcast, a show that covers business, career development, and tips to increase your income. And the best part, it's brought to you exclusively by the Revolt Podcast Network, anchored in hip hop, powered by creators.
Set of records that I worked on with Bobby Condors would have been my Bobby Condors, Mikey Jarrett, Mac Daddy, Ghetto Red Hot, and all those things. So what I decided to do was I left it alone for a while because I got bored. I was using all the hip-hop samples and putting them right underneath the raw Jamaican artists' vocals. Mm-hmm. But then I said, look, we're going to go between the classic section and the reggae section, and now these songs will now be the bridge. So you were going to play Heartbeat in the party anyway, and you might have played Aini Kamoze's Hot Stepper, guess what? I'm going to make the record that connects them both. And now how you get from the Heartbeats, the classic section, into your reggae is that you play these songs, thinking like a selector.
Yeah.
So I always thought like a selector, and I was a remixer, so I knew what to do. And now I created all these songs. So I did South Central for Supercat with the Gap Band. Shabba's Let's Get It On had Don't Look Any Further. Like, I just used all the records that made sense.
My last podcast, I had Willie Daniels and DJ Buck on the show. And they were talking about why reggae, they feel it's lost its heyday when you were putting out great music and in the 90s as well. Like, not even reggae, I should say, dancehall, because I think reggae is doing very well right now. What's your vibe with today's dancehall and the sound? And what do you think can be changed a little bit?
So first, I'll go bigger than that and say that music in general right now, not just dancehall, hip-hop, for instance.
Well, they said that as well,
right. So hip-hop in general, you know, what's become pop. Whatever was hip-hop always trickled into being the new R&B, then that trickled into becoming the new pop music. It's just a culture upstream, you know what I'm saying? the biggest hip-hop record of the week. Got on R&B Mary J. Blige record, and if it didn't make it there, then it went to Mariah Carey record, and next thing you know, it's the style that everybody's trying to copy. You know, whatever was happening, whether it was Teddy Riley, whether it was Timbaland, whether it was R. Kelly, that's how the motion goes. Hip-hop at this point has been very trap-oriented, which doesn't necessarily travel around the world well. The certain people like it, but you're in the same sonic frequency. The bass is where it's carrying all the energy. Not everybody's listening to bass. But then it's these melodies that have to kick through. And being that everything is really auto-tune based on a lot of vocals, it's almost as if you're singing through a harmonica. When you go to a harmonica and it's in the key of F, you cannot play anything outside of the key of F, so you pretty much get a... So you're stuck in that space. Not literally, but you're in the things, which is great for a sound and to do something. But when everything is that way, it's almost like we've made things robotic and there's no home cooking. So the balance is that when you transfer that energy that's happening around the world into what's happening in the dance hall, there is a space where there's a trap hall, dance hall blend of what's happening around the world that comes back. But what's missing is somebody still has to have, when you beat the wall, come through the mic. So it's just a sonic thing. I think it's a sonic thing, and it's a balance of, you know, at some point there were reggae people, and even dancehall from the 80s when you had Roots, Radix, and everything else. And then when Drum Machine come take over, I'm sure some people was cussing computer Paul. They was cussing computer Paul. Like, what's this? There was a point when Steely and Cleavy were doing stuff. And I'm sure prior to it really taking over, when Steely used to be in Roots, Radix as the band, then him and Cleavy now going and killing the whole track by themselves. Yo, the whole way we used to get $500. Now you only have to take $300. Just, you know, I'm sure there was a cussing. And then also, it was a robotic sound to dance hall, but the swing on it and the emotion in it and the sonic.
We still had a bass line.
And you had a bass line, but it was still moving a certain way. So those things would develop. At this point, I just feel like we could use a bit of balance so that everybody hears it and everybody has to do their thing. I'm not knocking anyone that's
doing trap for the club.
I don't knock anyone that's doing what they're doing on any genre. All I say is I can't complain unless I'm contributing what I want.
I agree.
So if I like it and I want to do something better, we'll just spend my money and do it. And if you like it, you come over here too. If you don't, stay where you're at.
All right, now let's go. We've got Do It For The Culture.
Do It For The Culture.
Do It For The Culture. Tell me, why are you doing it for the culture? Why have you created this brand? And we're going to go into the Red Bull Culture Clash as well.
Okay. So basically for me, when I turned 40, I went to work to Sony for 5 years. I had a label, Louder Than Life, that I started. Did really well. You know, Mac Wiles, I had Jordan Sparks, I saw a bunch of alternative groups. I had Hiatus Coyote as a jazz group on my Flying Buddha label. I put out things myself. We got some Grammy nominations. And then we had a huge few billion streamer with Omi's Cheerleader, which is, you know, from here, you know, Specialist. And I go back to the Shabba days, almost 30 years. And then when he had a new project, you know, prior to me going to Sony, we were working on some things with Omi. And that was able to still be a huge, huge, huge record that Sony still does massive business with every month, every year. It's a huge record. And, you know, number one on the Billboard pop charts for 6 weeks. Not one, not two, nothing. Six weeks.
It was big, massive, big global.
Song. So in that space, I really felt like, okay, cool. I wanted to have a label that did well. I ticked those boxes. And I got to the point where I'm like, well, what am I working for now? Why am I doing this? I'm not doing it for money. We're all right. I'm not doing it for hype because men are like people. I'm not doing it for a lot of other motivations. Why am I doing it? Because it's part of the culture of how I speak. It's part of the culture that I came up from. So I said, you know what? I'm going to go and I'm going to give away 50 records and put them online and not worry about the money. So I did a rap album. I did all sorts of stuff. And out of those 50 songs came a song that I did with Miguel called Come Through and Chill. That, you know, rather than me going to the label and saying, boom, give me $50,000, no. No, I was just like, yo, let's just put it on SoundCloud. Matter of fact, let's put it out. That same song from 2016, part of my Do It For The Culture and where I created this cover and this, you know, set of words for, got his Grammy nomination, then went on to be on his album. We added J. Cole as Gold. It was a success for me because me doing something because I thought it was the right thing to do actually turned into accolades later on. It was the perfect blend of commerce that came from creativity.
And it was the right pure. Place.
And that's where it's at. You know, for me, doing things that are the right thing for the right reason is there. So at this point, Do It For The Culture. This year, we started off, kind of started last year with Black Thought, Streams of Thought, but we've put out Nas and Amy Winehouse, Find My Love, Gallant, Roll the Dice. You know, I've put out EPs all through June with Bodega Bams and Joel Ortiz and all these different projects that, you know, Terrace Martin and I did a jazz EP that's just jamming. We did what we wanted to do. And right now, I'm in the reggae segment. We started in July. We put out my Thirsty Rhythm that had Busta and Major Hype on it.
Just so those funny.
That we just having fun and the songs and ideas I had. But now I'm really getting back into the other part of it where I'm dealing with the Red Bull Culture Clash.
Woo!
Do It For The Culture. And at the end of the day, is I stand in front of it. Because sometimes you need to make your intention known before you walk in the room.
Amen.
Why am I doing what I'm doing? You know, so just so you don't get it misconstrued, I'm here for the hype, I'm here for the money. No. I'm here for pushing the culture forward that I want to hear. And that's that. You know, culture ultimately will continue to grow and grow and grow.
So I didn't, again, I mentioned it in the last podcast, if you go guys and listen, but you tell me why you have the team that you have and the team that you have, they're all are integral parts of your life and your career. Right. So we can kick off with Spraga, what we were talking about, and then we can,
you know. I'll step back one step and say that with the Do It For The Culture aspect of it, when they came to me, they talked to me about hip-hop because, of course, I produced Nas, loads of records, and I've produced for many, many hip-hop artists, many, many R&B artists and pop artists. But being that it's a culture clash, they want a dance hall, soca and hip-hop. I can do that, but then my history is also I've produced a whole lot of reggae. So starting from the beginning with me, it was like, cool, you know, if I'm going to do a culture class, you know, it would even be different if it was in Miami. If it was in Miami, I might have dealt with it differently because I know the crowd is in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
But we're doing Red Bull culture. Once you put the word clash and Kingston together, Kingston clash, so we think I'm going to walk down here flat-footed and die? No. We're not showing up in no clash in Kingston with some Trick Daddy and some that's not with some Uncle Luke.
No.
We're not doing that. What we're doing is turn around the other way.
You just got an idea.
And then what we're doing is I was like, all right, cool. So Black Scorpio and I have been working together since Mega Banter's Soundboy Killing in 93. Scorpio's like my dad, my other dad. You know what I'm saying? They have me as a son from then. So I'm like, oh, Scorpio, clash thing. Clash, would I love that. November 2nd, my birthday too.
What?
Oh, Lord. No. What? I'm going to cancel my birthday party so I can be in the clash at the same time.
Wicked.
So Scorpio's birthday is November 2nd. Boom. Member number one on my team, which, you know, like I said, no new friends. These are all people I work with. And more than I work with. We was almost like family for a long time. Secondly, we have Josh Snowcone. Snowcone, the same time I met Scorpio, he used to, there's a sound in New York called GT Sound, which Snowcone was actually one of the selectors on the sound. So then he would be coming to the studio, and then eventually, over the years, you know, he would stay with me in New York and be my vice president of Ray Ray, my label at the time, Boom Tunes. So I would always be like that, and when any artist would come to New York, yo, you know, say such and such in town, yeah? Yo, make me book a hotel. Tell me, can change some tickets and come vice.
Yeah.
Cool. So the snow cone all through my, from 93 back to 2000 and whatever it was, anybody that came to Newark, it was always me and him vibing with the artist and my right hand to the point where his production understanding and songwriting levels kicked up. And then he went on to produce Temperature for Sean Paul. And, you know, right now, Rich is Right written with Riley Box theme. And
I love Riley Box, yeah.
Right, and with the By the Busy Signal. And
yeah.
Enough things coming up. Big up Earthworm. But ultimately, Cone is my right hand and always been. So for a certain amount of people that know me from back then, if you see me, you see Cone. If you see Cone, you see me.
Mm-hmm.
That's that family. So Scorpio, Cone there. Spraga, same thing. From the first time we worked, I think really we worked when he was on Capitol Records. So that would have been 94.
Mm-hmm.
From the time Spraga came in, me and him been tight. know, straight through, and our creative chemistry has always been there. And, you know, we're still the best of friends, you know what I'm saying? Through everything that's going on in his life in general, we've been locked in for 25 years now. So 94 to now, directly 25 years. So them three is that. Mm-hmm. Boom. Bambino, as many people have gotten to know him now from being on the radio and doing commercials, everything else here, prior to him moving back to Jamaica and doing this, he was in Miami. And when he was in Miami, we done spent Hurricane together. I can't have to get off my house on the beach because Hurricane coming up over Bambino house. I stay with him and his wife. Yo, we're in here. What we doing, yo?
Yeah.
You know, we're making up Hurricane songs. Bambi, only we can't tell them the Hurricane song. They have to go through a hurricane.
Yeah.
We made up Hurricane song, all type of stuff.
Bambi, may I go ask you if you do it for me, you know?
He's going to tell you. Exactly. It's a nice song. I guess. But anyhow, but like I said, me and him always linked up, and then he was working with my label. I put out tunes with Ghosts and different people years ago, Friendly Rhythm, even some things I ain't put out yet because I got enough tunes I ain't released yet. That's another story. But anyhow, Bambi was on my team from at least 2002 to 2003. So we got there. And then Disco Neil, who's the last member of the team, who some people don't know. But he
I didn't know. I didn't like, who is this
but,
guy?
But Neil DJs a lot around Miami and enough for different clubs, and he kind of does some parties and different things here. But he also was an intern and an assistant at my studio for many years prior to him getting his superstardom. He was always doing stuff, but he's just been in it and building. So Neil's part of my team because as he's in the current mix and current market and produce some tunes out there now that some people want to hire the credit, we're going to big you up. Disco Neil's part of my team because he's been part of my team. Everybody I'm talking about got keys to my house. Friends to the end. This is where it is. When the food cook, everybody eat. This is not nothing new. This is all my team. So that's the core of my team. There are other people who are going to come in and support.
Odessa.
Yes, Odessa is here. And once again, me and Odessa go back to her brother them.
Yeah.
And big up Saeed and Luke.
I don't mind repping the only female on the Do It Vocal Culture crew.
Exactly, exactly.
Because Clash life is my life.
We're going to work with the surprises because nobody can know what business, right?
Exactly. Nobody. Exactly. Nobody. Exactly.
Stay so. So basically, you know, that's it. And that's my team. But, you know, we're all focused on that. And then, you know, everybody's got different things going on. Like I said, Scorpio's birthday. Spraga just come off a number one album. Cole New Rhythm, my boss. Bambino have enough stuff that he ain't even show people he could do yet because he's working on his radio thing.
And I'm happy. Happy for that.
So for me, you know, it's just me and my team. And then our next step is to once again put things back for the culture. So everywhere I'm going, everybody I'm linking, everything I'm doing is back to the culture that built me. Because the work that I did in the reggae records from 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, all that stuff built the rest of my career. That turned into Amy Winehouse, Nas, all that stuff.
All right, boy, you know we can go on. We're going to do a part two, but I told you I want to do the part two in Miami.
All right.
With some rice and peas, some Sunday dinner.
There we go. Put with man the Sunday to work.
Dinner. To put man to work. Yo, Salah, like, people that don't know, he can throw down. And you know who gave me the secret? Was Chris Smith. He's like, yo, I'm at Salah's house right now, eating way. And my counteraction for him was, I'm at Screechy's by the beach. And he's like, all right.
Work all right,
you're
right?
In, you're in.
Yeah, but we have a beach too. We talk about that
later. All right, so this is Reasonings with Odessa with the man, the main man, doing it for the culture. Salam Remy, bless up.
Bless, bless.
All right, guys, thanks for listening to that episode of Reasonings. Thank you so much, Salam Remy. Banana, big time producer. I also would like to thank my Drinky Poo sponsors. I'm drinking white rum and orange juice right now. It's just... I feel so mellow. Anyway, guys, don't forget to subscribe and rate on Apple Podcasts or listen and, you know, just press that follow button on any podcast platform you choose to listen to. Until next week, I'm your host, Odessa. Linkage laters. Peace.
Hey there. Ever thought about what makes your heart beat a little faster?
Oh, you mean like when you discover a new track that just speaks to you?
Yeah. Or finding a movie that you can't stop thinking about?
Well, get ready to feel that excitement all over again because Amazon Prime is here to take your entertainment and shopping experience to the next level.
Absolutely. Prime isn't just about getting your packages quicker. It's about diving into a world of endless possibilities, from the latest releases to exclusive content you won't find anywhere else.
And don't even get me started on the music. Prime offers concert specials that will transport you right to the front room. It's like being at the hottest gigs without leaving your living room.
I use Prime to tap in with some of my favorite artists' live shows from any and every genre of music.
Trust me, Prime is a game changer. It's like having a personalized superstore and entertainment hub right at your fingertips.
So why wait? Head over to Amazon.com/Prime and start experiencing entertainment like never before.